that? I couldn't find the smaller Gemara. It's unbelievable. There was a fellow who used to go to the Daf Yomi with my father, and he used to schlep a Gemara like this. He used to come every morning at 5:30 in the morning with my dad to Daf Yomi. So one of the guys in the Daf Yomi said to him, "Why do you need to schlep such a humongous Gemara?" So he said, "You know, you sleep better in your own bed." So, Birshus the Morah D'Asra, Rabbi Engel, distinguished guests, and friends. So we want to think about why we're here this evening. So first of all, we're here to find out what the word collation means. Now, the word collation means a dessert or a small meal or refreshments. Let that be said. The second thing that we're not really here to do is not really to hear me, because people can hear me all the time. I'm here in the neighborhood. But we're here for one reason, and that is our love and our respect and our appreciation of the Korman family. And that's why we're here tonight. And I'm glad so many of us from our neighborhood are able to be here, and actually quite a few people right here on the computer, most notably Jacob Korman, who's in New York City. The Korman family, as we know, is a very special bunch. I'm not sure if she's here, although she's pretty technically savvy. And that is Mrs. Edie Korman, who sent me an email this afternoon, and that she is participating, whether she's going to be on the computer or not. It's special to have her as part of our community family. Some of you have seen her dart in and dart out in her special little vehicle that she drives. And, you know, if I had to adopt a second grandmother, a third grandmother, it would definitely be Mrs. Edie Korman. And we wish her well and all good health and a lot of simchas in her family. We're here because we have an attachment to three young men who are really, each in their own right, special individuals, and miyuchad b'minam, as we would say. You know, the oldest, that's Jacob, so he's to my left. He's now matriculating at Cardozo, and he's working like a dog, so that's why he's there where he belongs, and I'm sure Ira is very proud of the way that he's able to handle all of his studies, and he really works so hard, and he makes everyone proud. Jonathan, who is essentially now a member of the YU Torah Mitzion Kolel. If you've been to the Kolel in the last several months, he's been with us, and it's wonderful to have him, although we're unfortunately having him go on hiatus now for some exams of some sort. And then Leo, you know, Leo, when he walks into a room, when I came to the Ida Crown Jewish Academy, so I met Leo. So that was an experience. Because Leo, he just puts a smile on your face like nobody else can. And whether he looks like a lumberjack or he's clean-shaven, he has a certain warmth and a certain Avas Yisrael and a certain Avas HaTorah that's just infectious. And it's something that it enables you to attach yourself to him, but also to the great spirit that he carries with him. And finally, for Debbie, who is an extraordinary mother and a daughter and a human being and someone whose grace and strength inspires a lot of people in our community. So we're here all together tonight in memory and in respect to Ira, to Hillel Michal ben Aaron Zalman. Now the tradition is that Shmuel Hanavi, the prophet Samuel, was quite an accomplished man. We say on Friday night in the davening, Moshe ba'aron b'cho'anav, u'Shmuel b'korei Shemo. Shmuel was the one who anointed the first Jewish king. And Shmuel was one of, no question about it, one of the foremost Jewish leaders we have ever had. A person can accomplish a lot in 52 years. Shmuel lived for 52 years, according to the tradition. Shmuel, his tefilos, his koach, his energy, is the equivalent of Moshe and Aaron together. So while Ira, he lived a short life, he accomplished a tremendous amount, and we only can take a little piece with us and a legacy and things that we can learn for our own lives. But I think that's why we're here tonight. And the reason that I'm giving this year is because I've had the opportunity just to get to know him a little bit. It's funny because Debbie says they're the new family on the block. For us, they're old Skokians. They're like the Kormans, they've lived here forever. Although the truth is Debbie has lived here a lot longer than most of us. The truth is that for Ira, so it would have been appropriate that we have some world famous, world class speaker. But I think if that would have happened, he would have zapped me with a lightning bolt. He would have totally not been into that. Because what I'm here just as is just a member of our community. And tonight it's just about our community coming together to learn Torah. And if that's what it would be, I bet if we said to Ira, we're just going to have people get together and learn Torah, he would have said, that's a beautiful thing. That's what he would have said. And that's what it's about tonight. He was an extraordinary human being. And we'll talk about some of the things that we have learned and that we can continue to perpetuate that we learned from Ira. And again, I feel personally blessed to have the opportunity to have known the Korman family and getting to know first through Leo in the academy and John learning in the Kollel. And Ira, as we'll talk about later, being a very significant supporter of the Kollel behind the scenes as everything that he did. It's special for me to have the opportunity to share the Divrei Torah tonight. So what I'd like to do tonight, with your permission, and I hope many of you, everybody has the sheet of sources in front of you. Anybody not have a sheet of sources? Everybody's got? Okay. So instead of doing one cohesive presentation, what I'd like to do is break it down into four components, four perspectives on Jewish life, Torah perspectives on Jewish life, that we have learned and that we can continue to emulate from Ira, from his perspective. And the first is what we see and what he saw, what Ira saw. Now, Ira had a unique perspective on things, I think, because for some of you know, I worked for a company called Deloitte, which, as I'm told, is apparently a bunch of people who are running around checking how much money people have. That's basically what it is. They go around checking, make sure you have the right amount of money, not the wrong amount of money. They keep a track of the money. But apparently to do that, you have to go to people's books and you have to go checking around what they're doing and what they're up to. So Ira was constantly traveling. He was always on the run. He was always on the plane. I could have sworn that when you saw him come to sit down into shul, you would see him do this. I could have sworn that happened. I don't know if he ever tried to pull the oxygen mask down from the dining room in your house, but he was always on the go. And when he was here, we would see him in shul on a regular basis. But I think spending so many hours at 33,000 feet gave him a unique perspective that we can appreciate. See, I know when I travel with my kids, you look out the window, and what do you see when you look out the window? You see tiny dots that are houses, and maybe even fainter specks that are cars. And all the kids are like marveling, wow, look at this. It's so small, it's so tiny. So you know what's interesting? When you look from that altitude, it all just kind of blends in together. Everybody seems to get along from 33,000 feet. You can't tell the difference. You cannot figure out, well, which house is falling apart and which house seems to be a three-story. You can't tell the difference all the way up there, which attitude lives on this neighborhood and which attitude lives on that neighborhood. Because from 33,000 feet, everybody looks like they just get along, because everybody's a piece of the puzzle. And that was one of Ira's perspectives that he used to share, was the importance of seeing the Jewish community as a whole. And as he told me, he has been through different areas of the Jewish community. And those who remember a year ago, it's hard to believe it's 1 year, the different segments of the Jewish community who came together. There are a lot of different segments that were represented there. Most of the people, I had no idea who they were. But I found that afterwards, this one is from this neighborhood and this community and this. All these various distinctions that to Ira didn't need to be there and shouldn't have been there. There's no such thing as distinctions. It's all one Jewish community. And that's something that he saw. And that's a very important teaching. And that's one of the most fundamental teachings of the Baal HaTanya. The first Lubavitcher Rebbe, his name was Rav Schneur Zalman of Liadi. So he founded Chabad and wrote one of the most important treatises in Chassidus. And it's known as the Sefer HaTanya, because the first word starts with Tanya. And in there, in the 32nd chapter of the Tanya, he speaks about exactly this idea. If you look on your source number one in your packets. Take off my jacket, Leo. Is that all right? Okay. The reason to remember that this is in the 32nd chapter of the Tanya is because it's the lave. It's really the heart of what the Baal HaTanya is getting at. He says, we have to realize that all Jews, L'chei Nikru Kol Yisrael Achim, all Jews are considered brothers, mamish, literally, why? Mitzad Shorish Nafsham Bahashem Echad. Because our souls are really one. Rak Shehagufim Mechulakim. just that our bodies are separated. But on the inside, all the souls are connected. How does that make sense? Because, so to speak, God Almighty, which is this transcendent being, is the source of all these sparks of holiness in everybody. Everybody has this chelek elokam mal. Everybody has this little spark of the divine. That's their neshama. We would call it our emotional makeup, our feelings, our experiences, our soul. So that little spark that's in each one of us, that doesn't change over time. It develops. It grows, but it doesn't change. Our body, that changes over time. So it goes through all kinds of changes. But the distinctions are only outside. It's only in the body. But inside, all those souls, they all come from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They all come from God. So they're all connected. There's no such thing as distinguishing between Jews. All Jews are one. You open the Aron Kodesh and you take out a Sefer Torah. So what are they going to do? After the laning, in Sephardic shuls they do it before the laning, they open up for Hagbah. They open the Sefer Torah really wide. So can you tell what's the difference one letter from the other? So if you look very closely, you can distinguish between a Resh and a Hey and a Ches and a Kuf. But from far away, it's just a series of letters. Well, the tradition teaches us that the word Yisrael, which is the name for the Jewish community, Yisrael, is Yesh Shishim Ribo Osios LaTorah. There are 600,000 letters in the Torah. Now, there are not. If you open it up, you will count. You will not find. You'll find 300 some thousand. But conceptually, the rabbi said, what it means is there are 600,000. What does that mean, 600,000 letters? It means, well, 600,000 people left Egypt, 600,000 letters in the Torah. Every Jew is a letter. Every Jew is a letter. It doesn't matter where you come from. Doesn't matter what your background is, what your education is. Every single Jew is a letter in the Sefer Torah. And the truth, that you know, the matter is that every single Jew is indispensable. There's no such thing as a Sefer Torah with a missing letter. If you take out a Sefer Torah and the fellow is reading the Torah and he finds this one letter missing, if there's one Jew who's out of place in the Jewish community, you wrap it up, you put it away. The Sefer Torah is disqualified. Because the Sefer Torah, which is in the embodiment of the Jewish community as a whole, it includes every single one. And in the converse, if you look at the Sefer Torah as a meta-narrative about all of us, each one of us is a Sefer Torah. Because according to the Gemara, if God forbid, if somebody's present, when someone leaves the world, when their soul departs, so they rip kriya, Rachmanu Litzlan, they tear their shirt. Why? Because the Gemara has an analogy. It says it's like a Sefer Torah being burned. Doesn't matter who the Jew was. Doesn't matter, it could be the most knowledgeable or the least knowledgeable. It doesn't matter. Every Jew is a Sefer Torah unto themselves, and every Jew is a part of the great Sefer Torah of the Klal Yisrael. You see that from 33,000 feet. Ira saw that, and he always wanted to bring Jews together, irrespective. He didn't see their backgrounds. That's something that we have to see. What we can see in our own lives is that big Sefer Torah with all the letters in it. Every single letter is important. That's number one. Number two. What we hear, what Ira heard. So 2 weeks ago, we read in the Parsha about Yisro. Now, I never heard Ira talk about his in-laws. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But in the Torah, we are introduced to the first in-laws, and that his name was Yisro. So Yisro, he comes along, and he appears on the scene with plenty of advice from Moshe Rabbeinu. So, that sounds like it's a good fit for a father-in-law, for a son-in-law. So Yisro is telling Moshe Rabbeinu all these kind of things. But the truth is that as much as we want to rib Yisro a little bit, it's quite a significant accomplishment that a Chumash, that one of the Parshios, according to tradition, is named after this guy, Yisro. Now we know that Yisro, his background, we're not sure exactly where he came from, what kind of an idolater he was. He was apparently a very colorful character. He shows up on the scene, and he says, Moshe Rabbeinu, I have some ideas for you. And the Torah actually gives you quite a few psukim to tell you where he was from, who he was, what his journey was like, and how he shows up and makes a contribution. So we call a parsha after this fellow, and we give you all these psukim, and there's not an extra word in the Chumash. So what's the story with that? I want to understand what's the significance of Yisro. That's one piece of the puzzle. Another piece of the puzzle here is something about listening. What we hear, and more specifically what we listen to, it's something that we do twice daily, maybe even more. I would bet every person in this room is familiar with the Shema. We say the Shema every single day. And not only that, it's actually a mitzvah d'oraisa. It's a biblical commandment to say the Shema. So now I realize there's a biblical commandment to say the Shema, just like it's a biblical commandment to come and hear the shofar. Have this opportunity every single day. But Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that there's something different about this commandment than every other commandment. There's a book that was published posthumously of essays. It's called Worship of the Heart. This belongs to the shul. And it's published by the Torah Sarab Foundation. And in here, he talks about one opinion in the Rishonim, one school of thought from 1,800 years ago that says, wait a second, there's something unique about this mitzvah than every other mitzvah. And what's that about? Imagine I took a nap. I don't know how this would be possible, but it's possible, I guess. I could take a nap in the afternoon on Sukkot, and someone could hand me the Dalet Minim in my sleep. I could do a lot of things in my sleep, so I wonder if I could do this. And I could hold the Dalet Minim in my sleep. Would I fulfill my obligation of taking the Dalet Minim by holding that in my sleep? What if I'm racing down the street on Rosh Hashanah, let's say the Or Torah groups, somebody spilled their juice on my kid's sweater. So the first thing they do is they come into shul, they tell you your kid needs, you know, the sweater. You come racing out like 100 miles an hour coming out, and there's a tent, it's heated, it's air conditioned, it has a floor, it's all good. You're running out there, and as you're running out the door, in the other minyan, in the small base medrash, they're blowing the shofar. Now I had no intention of listening to the shofar. I'm running out to save my child from drowning in the spill that Steve Lubavitch is laughing because he's seen so many of these kids. I'm running out to save his sweater from, you know, disaster, and I heard the shofar just by the by as I'm walking out. So the shaila is, am I yotzei the mitzvah of tkiyah shofar? So what would you say? Yes or no? Anybody who says yes, hands up, we'll see who's still awake. I'm yotzei the mitzvah of tkiyah shofar. No, not yotzei the mitzvah. Oh, okay. That's a pretty overwhelming majority. There is a machlokas. It's a debate in the Talmud, it's a debate in the Poskim, whether or not a person fulfills their obligation just by hearing the shofar by the by. Yes, says Rav Soloveitchik, that's a debate in shofar. Might be a debate in lulav, but it's not a debate in Kriyat Shema. He points out that what he calls normative heedfulness or imperativistic motivation, now I know what collation is, but I don't know what exactly this means. That's why we have Rabbi Engel. Normative help heedfulness or an imperativistic motivation, an intention of acting in accord with the divine will which decreed the norm. That's what we call kavana, intent. So we have a debate. Do you need kavana or not? So maybe for the shofar you do, maybe you don't. But for Kriya Shema you need kavana. You must have attention. If you just say Kriya Shema without even noticing that you're saying Kriya Shema, it's like you're reading the newspaper. You're not yotzei the mitzvah of Kriya Shema. Even if you might have been yotzei, according to half the opinions, you might have been yotzei in the hallway with the hearing of the shofar. You're not yotzei in the Kriya Shema. Why not? Because Kriya Shema, that's a call. It's a call, a clarion call of faith. It's not just an action that we do or don't do. It's Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shemaim. It's a mission-driven statement. And we're either listening to it or we're not listening to it. And if you're not listening to it, it's not going to do anything. You have to listen to it because the next verse is V'ahavta as Hashem. It gives us a charge. We got to take the Shema. We have a relationship with God and we're going to take it. And we're going to run with it to fulfill our mitzvot. In the second chapter, we're going to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's a call. We got to listen to do something. We got to do something. Says the Holy Kutzker Rebbe. You know what was so special about Yisro? You know why we give him so much honor? We have so much attentiveness to Yisro. Because Vayishma Yisro, he heard. Everybody heard. What do you mean? The whole world heard. Chil achaz yoshvei pelashas. Everybody heard. But you know what? Yisro picked himself up and did something about it. Vayishma Yisro, he didn't just hear, he listened. He took the Shemiyah, the listening that he had, and he put it into practice. He picked himself up and he picked up his family, comes to Moshe Rabbeinu. And he says, I want a piece of this. I want to be a part of your journey. I don't remember all the names of all the people who I heard about on the journey. Lahavdil bein Chaim l'Chaim, that Debbie took, that Ira took, that they took together. The different people he told about, who he heard from. A lot of people, we all hear things. People listen to me, they don't listen to me. But Ira, he listened to someone. And he listened to different people over the course of his life. And he took that listening, whatever he heard, and he made it into a journey. He made it into a journey from where he started to the legacy that he left us. Because it wasn't just about just hearing the shofar passing in the hallway. When he came to a shul, I remember exactly the story where he came and he heard the rabbi's drasha, forget which shul already, somewhere in the northern suburbs, somewhere north of here. He took that message, he took that word, and he did something about it. He ran with it. And he went on a journey. Wow. We hear things all the time. What we hear, the question is, to what do we listen? How do we take the Shema, the Vayishma Yisro that the Kotzer talks about, and put it into action? That's the second component. We see a lot of things, we hear a lot of things. Then the question is, so what do we do? So I want to focus on two aspects, on two thoughts. The first is a very basic, elementary thing. I didn't bring a marker. And I'm not going to take out the Torah, but I'm going to make a drawing here. Because the Gemara asks you to consider what the Hebrew alphabet looks like. And says, you know what? Ask your kids when they're growing up, when they're going to kindergarten. I was in my son's kindergarten class this morning. If they know the Aleph Beis. And they say, yeah, they know all the Aleph Beis. And the Talmud says, you know what? Every letter of the Aleph Beis is very important. Look at this diagram. We start Aleph Beis, Gimel Dalet. The rabbi said, what do these letters mean? Well, actually, the Talmud of Masechet Shabbos takes the time out to analyze what is the significance of these letters. So if you look on your page here, in source 3, source 2 is what I quoted from Yisro, source 3, the rabbi said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Now this Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi is one of the most important sages of the Talmud. Anytime he has a dispute with someone else, in 98% of the cases, the ruling follows him. What is he telling us? He's telling us, what should we tell the kindergartners? Asu dardegia in the lebe midrashi. The kindergarten kids came to the house of study and they said something that was so incredible, it was beyond even Yehoshua ben Nun. Gimel Dalet. What is the significance of the letter Gimel and Dalet? Says the Gemara. You see where I put the little arrow on source 3. Gimel Dalet stands for Gemol Dalim. Care for the needy. Gimel Dalet, Gemol Dalim. My taima, says the Gemara, Pshuta Kare de Gimel Lagabe Dalet. Why is the foot of the Gimel facing the Dalet? All right, this is not drawn to scale, nor is it Ksav Ashuri. This is not a rabbinic script, but if you get my gist here, there's a gimel, the foot of the gimel faces the dalet. So you have Aleph Bet, Gimel Dalet. So the rabbis are asking the question, a profound question. Why is the foot of the gimel stretched out to the dalet? Why is that the tradition? Maybe the gimel should have been backwards. Why is it facing this way? Says the Gemara, I'll tell you why. Shekein darko shel gomel chasadim larutz achar dalim. Because the way of a gomel chasadim, somebody who does kindness, is to chase after the poor people. Gomel dalim teaches us a very profound lesson. The dal, the people who are in need, they're facing the other way. They can't even see the gimel. They can't even see the people who are chasing them to give them a hand. That's the way it's supposed to be. But Gemol Dalim, the Chumash, the Torah, Hashem, He doesn't want us to do chesed. That's not what He wants us to do. He wants us to be rodev chesed, to pursue kindness. You think about Avram Avinu. So what was he doing according to the Torah on the third day after his bris milah? He was sitting at the entrance of his house, kachom ayom. Why? Because he was looking for guests. Obviously, Avram Avinu, if he would have been sitting in his tent and someone came to his house, knocked on the door, of course he would have given them a cup of iced tea. But that wasn't it. Avinu says, that's not the model of Gemol Dalim. I want to make sure that I could be on the cutting edge so I could see out there who needs help. To be attentive, not just to be reactive. That was something that Ira did. He did very quietly. But he wasn't just waiting for someone to call him. He was attentive. He was involved in trying to find out what are the needs of others. Gomel Dalim. His foot was always chasing the Dalet. He was always on the lookout for what you could do for somebody else. That was one. Another significant midah, and we could spend a lot of time, but I want to focus on one more thing that we can do besides Gomel Chesed. There is a great teacher of the Mishnah. Rabbini Lau has a sefer called The Sages. It became very popular. The second volume just came out. John told me it's at the Sfarim sale now. So he talks about the different sages of the Talmud, and he speaks about Hillel the Elder. So Hillel the Elder was one of the most important sages of our tradition. He came from Babel, from Babylonia, to Eretz Yisrael during the time of the Beis HaMikdash. And he had a specific perspective on the world. He brought almost a democratic sense to the study of Torah, whereas beforehand, it was significantly limited to the elite of the Jewish community. Hillel opened the doors and said, essentially, anybody wants to come and learn, just like I did. He was a student of Shemaiah and of Talion, of two great sages, and he opened the doors. And this, some of you are familiar with a famous story. A ger, a convert, comes to Hillel. He says, teach me the whole Torah on one foot. So his counterpart, Shammai, said, one foot, get out of here. And Hillel says, no, I could work with this. Hillel had a sense of how to connect very profoundly with other people. He was very acutely aware of social needs. So therefore, when there was a financial crisis, because there was a credit crunch due to Shemitah, every 7 years, all debts go out the window. So now Hillel says, no one's going to lend money. There's going to be a credit freeze. So what do? So he says, we have a rabbinic mechanism called a prusbul that we're going to institute so that we can make sure that the capital, or whatever they call it in that world, the money goes. We got to make sure that the money goes. So the people who need the money get the money. Everybody can run their business. Hillel was very aware of this. So Hillel understood interpersonal relationships very well. What did Hillel teach us in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos in Source 4? He taught us Kneh Lecha Chaver, acquire for yourself a friend. I don't know too many people who had the kind of friends that Ira has. That he has. It was really, those who remember, who were around the Shiva house, this Michael and that Michael and this one and that one, they spoke all the time. All the time, on a regular basis. They were so involved in each other's lives. Because it's Kneh Lecha Chaver that's so important. And the look at the language here, Kneh Lecha, acquire. Because when you acquire something, you invest in it. You got to put yourself into it. You got to pick up the phone. You got to take the time out and invest. And what do you have at the end? You have to have a chaver. Leit chaber, to connect to somebody. Ira's friends are so connected to him. They're so connected to the family, to Debbie, to the boys, to everybody. They're just totally connected. They're like family. And we need to learn from that. It's something we can do. Now, there's a Tim McGraw song on the radio now. Sometimes he learns that going fishing ain't such an imposition. To take out the time, Kneh Lecha Chaver, to develop a friendship with someone. These are things that we can do in our own lives, that we can learn. These are timeless lessons of Chazal that Ira, he accomplished in this really unique manner. So how do we do it? And for this I'll move to the fourth piece. How do we do it? How did Ira do it? So the first way, I think, that needs to be said has to do with demanding excellence and a culture of excellence. In this gigantic Gemara that I brought, there is one line that struck me. The Gemara says in Shabbos, Dafayin Dalet Amud Beis, that each of the activities that we don't do on Shabbos are learned from the fact that they were done in a constructive manner in the Mishkan. That's essentially what it is. God, He does all the creation one day a week. We think we do the creation 6 days a week, especially today with online bill pay and the direct deposit comes right to my account. I don't pray for my parnassah. It just gets deposited. Just everything comes from somebody else on my phone, on my... We have to remember one day a week, we're not the creators, God's the creator. So we have 39 different activities that are creative that we say we don't do on Shabbos, and we found them in the Mishkan. So the rabbi said one of the 39 has to do with matir, untying a knot. So rabbis are trying to figure out, well, where in the Mishkan where they're untying knots? So the Gemara has a suggestion. Imagine, look at this parochus. Imagine this was the curtain in the Mishkan. And the Mishkan had curtains all the way around, and it had two veils like with curtains. So it had threads running all the way through. So imagine, the Gemara says, you had two threads that had ripped, and you tied them on the ends.
And then you know what you're going to do? They got tied up on the ends. You're going to untie the two knots and then tie the two strings together. That's what the Gemara suggests. As a Havamina, maybe we had two knots and then we're going to put them back together. Gemara says, are you nuts? Are you crazy? V'chilifnei melech basar v'dam einos kein. You wouldn't do that in your own house. I wouldn't fix my curtains that way. You're going to put knots in it? L'fnei melech malchei hamlachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu osen. You're going to do that for God? Are you nuts? No, it must be learned from something else. There's no such thing as shortcuts in life, in religious life in particular, in our spiritual aspirations. We have to work hard and we have to develop a culture of excellence. We can't stand mediocrity in everything that we do, whether it's in our job, in our homes, and our commitment to our families, and our commitment to Hashem. There's no such thing as mediocrity. We're going to talk about in the parsha how they built this Mishkan. Lachshov machshovos. Let's think about this for a minute. Let's think about that. How are we going to do this the right way? We got Bezalel and a whole bunch of volunteers. Lachshov machshovos. To think it out so it should be a place of absolute perfection. There's no such thing as knots. We're not going to build a Beis HaMikdash, a shul, a community institution, a family. We're not going to build it with knots in it. No, we're going to demand excellence from ourselves, from our community, from our kids, from our students. We need to set the bar high. We can't compromise. We need to have excellence. That was one thing that he stood for and that he himself worked tirelessly at. But then there was another thing. And I'm sure this is probably why, if he could, I would get in big trouble from doing this. But that's the notion of modesty. The Pasuk tells me in the last source on your page, in Micha, says, Higil lecha adam atov. I told you, matov, what is good? Uma Hashem doresh mumcha, what does God want from you? Kiyem asos mishpat, to do justice, va'avas chesed, and to love kindness, v'hatznei aleches im elokecha, to walk modestly with God. Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb has a phenomenal essay on tznius. I highly recommend it. It's in a book called 70 Faces, but I Xeroxed it, so I'm assuming that he wouldn't mind if I shared it with everybody if you'd like it afterwards. He develops the notion that tznius, that modesty, is a universal concept, and it's so true. Because what is tznius? What is modesty? It says that if I have something special, if I have something that's dignified, that's private, I'm going to keep it to myself. If I overexpose everything in my life, then what's special for me? And where does this come from? This comes from God himself. God is a kel mistater. God hides in the shadows. He doesn't walk around giving handouts all the time. He's in the shadows. So much so that when Moshe Rabbeinu comes to the snet, to the burning bush, and he sees God, what does he do? He covers his face. So is Eliyahu HaNavi. He says, you can't look at God. There's something special. There's something holy. And when it's holy, you cover it over. That maintains the person's dignity. You'll talk about it when you think about the big day kahuna. Why do you wear clothing? Well, the Kohen Gadol wears clothing. L'chavod u'l'sifares. Tiferes means splendor. What does it look like on the outside? I dress the way that I am, whatever the context is. If I'm in a formal setting, I dress formally. But that's for the other people. The first way is l'chavod, to protect my own dignity. I cover everything up. It has nothing to do with everybody else. I maintain my own dignity, so I keep it covered up. Something special. And that's the way Ira did everything. He would not like the fact that we were doing this. Not at all. Because for Ira, everything had to be Hasnei Alecha Sem Elokecha. Everything that he did that was so special, whether it was devoted to a whole host of different causes, or in his own family, or the way that he treated his parents, or his kids, or the people who were close with him, it was always done b'sheket. It was always done quietly, modestly. It was b'hatznei alecha sim elokecha. Because he knew that something that was so precious, you need to protect it. You need to protect the dignity of it. And you just, as they say in Yiddish, still a hate. You just keep it quiet. These are some of the things I think that we can learn from our tradition. These are a lot of, it's a beautiful thing. It's a lot of beautiful things. And that's a phrase that I learned from him. And it's very special. It's a very special perspective on life. The things that we see, the things that we hear, what we do and how we do them, we can take many lessons from his life and bring them to ours.
We live with a lot of questions in our life, and we often don't have answers to these questions. I certainly don't have answers to these questions. There are many big questions. But the question of what we can do and what we can take for ourselves, I think that's a question that we can answer. We can look at someone who led a life that can inspire us. We can take that. We can learn from that. And we can carry that legacy on in our own lives. Yehi Zichro Baruch. Leo, now going to make a siyum in memory of Ira.